You're listening to Back in the USSR. Listening to Back in the USSR here on 93.3 FM CFRU, I am Siegfried, and it's very hard for me to know where to begin. I think I'll begin with, of course, telling you about that song. That is a song by Quilapayún, a Chilean band with very political music, and that particular performance was of a song called The People United Will Never Be Defeated. You know, El Pueblo Unido Llamase Ha Vencido. You know, it's a very, very iconic song. It was sung in Santiago, Chile in 1973, that particular performance. And basically just a few months before Augusto Pinochet's coup, U.S.-backed and CIA-backed coup, overthrew the progressive leader Salvador Allende. You know, a event which lives in infamy to this day and in Latin America. And that song really embodies just the strength of the people in South and Central America and their resistance against imperialism, which goes on even now. Because imperialism tried to break Latin America. It tried to break Latin America. It imposed military dictatorships on Latin America. It intervened militarily in Latin America. It imposed plunder by foreign corporations, mostly American corporations, on Latin America. You know, brutalized the people, sent in death squads, you know, murder gangs, you know, you name it, you know, they've been subjected to it. And yet, look where Latin America is now. Stronger than ever. It's coming together. It's standing strong. It's increasingly standing up to the United States. And to those foreign imperialist powers that would brutalize it and try to exploit it. You know, because the people there, of course, have awakened. They've taken a stand. And I was very privileged to be a part of the stand that they are making around one particular issue. And that is with regard to the struggle right now of the people of Ecuador, particularly the indigenous people of Ecuador, against the U.S. oil giant Chevron and what it has done since the 1960s to the Amazon rainforest in that country through its oil drilling, its dumping of toxic materials, its abuse of the indigenous population, you know, you name it. It's left like this total destruction in its wake. And the people of Ecuador have been fighting for justice against Chevron, trying to get justice for years on this. And fortunately, the progressive government of Ecuador, President Rafael Correa, has really pressed this home. Chevron has been forced to leave Ecuador. But the fight for justice, the fight for compensation for the immense destruction which Chevron has left against the environment and the people of the rainforest provinces in Ecuador, which of course has left soaring cancer rates, illnesses, destruction of the environment that people depend on for food and for water. You know, just this total devastation. Chevron has to answer for that. And they've tried to take Chevron to court multiple times. Chevron's used a lot of dirty tricks, you know, gotten U.S. judges to throw out the case against it. Fortunately, the battle continues. The International Court in The Hague has sided with the people of Ecuador against Chevron. And currently that case is before a court, the Supreme Court of Ontario, and I believe a court in the United States as well. So, I mean, the battle for justice really continues here. I was part of a caravan just this past week. This was on Monday and Tuesday. I was part of a caravan of people coming from Toronto who went down to Washington, D.C., and held a demonstration outside the IMF and World Bank building in Washington, D.C., in Edward Morrow Park. And we made our voices heard. There were voices of indigenous people who came down to Washington, D.C., from Six Nations and from South America as well, from Great Turtle Island and the Land of the Condor, and joined hands and took a stand against Chevron, understanding this is part of the greater struggle against colonialism. And they understand that they have a common enemy, they have a common cause, and people are joining hands across borders in this struggle. This is very, very important, and this was very, very moving to be a part of. Now, before I really get into some of the details, I really want to give you some background about Chevron and the destruction is wrought in South America and the fight to get justice by the Ecuadorian people. So I'm going to play this clip from the Real News Network. They put this out just this past week. And it really kind of outlines all the details of the case and really what's been going on. So I want to play that first. So please stay tuned to Back in the USSR.
Welcome to the Real News Network. I'm Sharmini Peres, coming to you from Baltimore. In February 2011, an Ecuadorian court found Chevron guilty of one of the largest environmental disasters on the planet and ordered the oil giant to pay $18 billion. And then later, it was reduced to $9.5 billion in environmental damages for dumping nearly 16 billion gallons of toxic oil, drilling water waste into the rivers in the Amazon. The water supply that thousands of people rely on each day. Let's have a look at what some of the people living in the area had to say.
Yo tengo matado unos dos, tres hijos así. Niñas así, muertas así. Andaban para hacer para la yucha. Andaban hasta puro crudo andaban. Después contenían se morían.
The civil society group Amazon Watch recently released some secret tapes sent to their organization by Chevron whistleblower. Let's have a look at what that is all about.
Nice job, Dave. One simple task.
Who picked the spot, Renee?
Don't buy
coal. Who picked the spot, Renee?
Oh.
Told them where to drill, Renee.
My fault? I'm the customer. I'm always right.
Chevron called the ruling illegitimate and vowed to fight it. In 2014, a U.S. federal court judge sided with Chevron and threw out the environmental damages ruling, altogether arguing that it was obtained through corrupt means. Well, on Monday, April 20th, the federal appellate court in Manhattan heard oral argument in the appeal of those charges. Joining us now from New York to discuss all of this is Paul Paz y Miño. Paul has been a professional human rights advocate with the expertise in Latin America for more than 20 years. He's a director of outreach and online strategy at Amazon Watch and has overseen the Clean Up Ecuador campaign for the past 8 years. Thank you so much for joining us, Paul.
Thank you.
So, Paul, give us a sense of what happened in court.
Well, today we heard the appeal arguments for Chevron's retaliatory RICO attack against the Ecuadorians and their lawyers. And what's important to note is that the decision that's under appeal doesn't in any way stop the Ecuadorians from enforcing their legitimate verdict in Ecuador or anywhere else in the world. The appeal, the decision that was appealed today was an injunction preventing the Ecuadorians and their lawyers from benefiting from that verdict in the United States, which is, of course, the only place they actually have jurisdiction. Nonetheless, the appeal was brought forth, and in court, I and many others were quite surprised to see the vehemence with which some of the justices questioned the Chevron attorneys. Most amazingly, at one point, one of the justices simply asked Chevron's lawyer, Ted Olson, when is this going to end? And emphatically asked again, when is this going to end? They berated them for bringing similar allegations up at an international tribunal at The Hague at the same time as pursuing RICO trials here, because essentially Chevron has been playing a legal shell game, forum shopping wherever it can, trying to get verdicts in its favor, and trying to find a venue where it can defend itself without resorting to discussing the actual facts in Ecuador. And then most surprisingly of all, one of the justices offered to Chevron, why don't you retry the case right now in New York? You tried it in Ecuador and lost. If you want to try it again, what can we force you to try it here? And of course, this caught Chevron's lawyers, their entire legal team, completely off guard. The last thing they want to do is have to defend themselves based on the facts of what happened in Ecuador in any court, which they've actually publicly said that they don't think this case belongs in any court. But most importantly, this would essentially be a trial about enforcing the verdict in Ecuador. And they would call it a retrial, but it's essentially the same thing the Ecuadorians are pushing for now in Canada, to enforce their legitimate verdict, to force Chevron to pay the $9.5 billion that it owes to clean up and help the Ecuadorians with the health costs for the wave of cancers and other health-related illnesses or oil-related illnesses that they've suffered.
So, Paul, even Bloomberg Business said that Chevron used the Racketeering Act inappropriately and that it influenced the court and disrupted the court organization and boundaries of RICO. What does all of this mean?
Well, that's the ironic thing. I mean, I'm not a lawyer, and I know there were plenty of legal experts in the room right there, and the legal ground for their case is paper thin at best, because these actions that they're alleging didn't even take place in the United States. The only reason they've been able to find a way to use the RICO hook is because one of the lawyers working on the case, Stephen Donziger, resides in New York. And so by the longest stretch of a hook, they've decided that because he's located here, they can try to invalidate the legitimate judgment of the nation of Ecuador, which has been upheld by 8 justices, and it's gone to their highest courts. And before they've even sought to enforce it in the United States, Chevron hit them preemptively with a RICO suit, which frankly is nothing more than a slap suit. And unfortunate reality is, because Chevron can hire 60 law firms and 2,000 legal professionals and 4 PR firms and spend close to $2 billion fighting this fight, they've been able to push it to this level where they're actually taking a slap suit all the way through to this level of federal court, and it has to be appealed. The other telling factor about this RICO case is that no evidence of the contamination in Ecuador was actually permitted in court. And that can't be overstated. The whole reason that Chevron is fighting this is because they claim the allegations against them are not valid. And yet the judge didn't look at the actual evidence or allegations against them, including the videos that you mentioned in your opening that were turned over to Amazon Watch by a whistleblower. They were suppressed by the same judge that issued the RICO verdict in favor of Chevron.
And what rationale was used to suppress these tapes?
All evidence of contamination was struck from the record. And these tapes show evidence of Chevron's own employees and contractors finding toxic contamination in areas that they swore and still swear to this day are fully remediated and non-toxic. So from the very beginning, Chevron argued successfully with Judge Kaplan to prevent any discussion of actual contamination. And these videos show that. So he blocked it. Although, interestingly enough, he did allow Chevron to enter into evidence edited outtakes from a documentary made about the toxic contamination in Ecuador called Crude by Joe Berlinger. Those clips were allowed, and they were actually edited. And the defense in the RICO case showed how they were edited to mislead the judge into believing that there was something nefarious going on that wasn't, and yet he still permitted them. The amount of bias that went on in Judge Kaplan's RICO case would make the layman on the street with even a rudimentary understanding of our judicial system gasp. The entire case is founded on the testimony of a corrupt witness who was admittedly receiving up to $2 million from Chevron in order to testify, which is a clear violation of ethics. And in our view, it should invalidate his entire testimony because it's been bought and paid for by Chevron. But time and again, the only cases you'll find of anyone defending them are people that they've either intimidated, threatened with legal action, or paid off in this case.
And just so that we set the record straight here, how do we know Chevron is absolutely responsible for the spill, particularly given that there's been some reports that the Ecuadorian state company itself was also drilling in the same place?
Sure. Well, it's important to note, Chevron at Texaco admitted during the first stage of this trial to deliberately discharging almost 16 billion gallons of toxic foundation waters into the Ecuadorian Amazon over the course of their time as the sole operator there. There's no doubt whatsoever, and they don't contest, that they made the actual financial decision to dump toxic pollutants into what was the pristine Amazonian rainforest. Texaco was the first company to drill for oil in the rainforest in history, and they created 916 open-air waste pits to dump their toxic waste. The normal practice everywhere else in the world and by law in the United States was to re-inject the foundation waters because they're toxic and the only safe thing you can do with them is return them into the ground. But rather than do that as a cost-cutting measure, they dumped it and they admitted dumping it. What they have said is that after they left in 1992, the responsibility from that point forward is Petro Ecuador's, the state oil company of Ecuador. Nobody is absolving Petroecuador of its responsibility for any environmental damage that happened subsequently. But unfortunately for Chevron, 18 billion gallons of toxic waste doesn't just disappear even after decades. So the initial crime that they created, which is still polluting to this day, still sits there. And there's no way for them to hide it, which is exactly why they've resorted to a legal campaign of vilifying their critics and trying to destroy the careers of the human rights lawyers who are holding them to account. They simply can't defend themselves on the evidence. And again, in 1992, when they left, Chevron claims that Texaco signed an agreement with the government of Ecuador to remediate a portion of the 916 pits and well sites left behind. The evidence of these tapes that have been leaked show that even the small portion that they claim to have remediated are toxic. So there's nowhere left for Chevron to hide. First, they're responsible wholly for the things they did as sole operator. Second, even the feeble defense that they had of remediating a small portion is completely blown out of the water when you see their own tapes showing the toxic contamination still there more than a decade after they claimed it was cleaned up.
And Paul, just also give us a headline on what's going on in The Hague right now. I understand that Chevron is seeking to hold the Republic of Ecuador accountable for their role in denying Chevron's justice through an international arbitration. What is all that?
Well, there's no dearth of creativity in Chevron schemes to try to find someone else to be responsible for their crimes. And in this case, they're essentially trying to make the Ecuadorian taxpayer cover their burden for what they did in Ecuador. They're trying to sue Ecuador under a bilateral trade agreement, which is completely undemocratic. It doesn't allow the Ecuadorian plaintiffs to even be in the room, let alone present evidence in their case. So we consider it to be completely invalid and inappropriate. But their argument is that they weren't afforded due process in Ecuador, and therefore Ecuador's government needs to be responsible. The irony, of course, is that this is the most litigated case in the history of Ecuador. It's been reviewed by 8 judges there, and the evidence against them, the evidence that was used to determine their liability was almost overwhelmingly Chevron's own evidence submitted to the court. And yet they're still able to push this through this trade agreement with The Hague. It appoints 3 justices or members of the tribunal who are paid. They've already profited quite a lot of money just overhearing this case. And it doesn't allow the actual affected people to have a voice in their venue. So we don't consider that a legitimate method for Chevron to respond. Ironically, it came up bite them quite hard today in the Second Circuit when one of the justices continually asked why they were seeking this case in The Hague at the same time as they launched their RICO attack, because you had a totally separate body with different evidence, more access to Ecuador, who might come to a completely different verdict about the Ecuadorian judiciary and the decision. So the Justice Wesley continued to ask, what would you do if you got a different verdict there versus here? How do you reconcile that? Why were you doing that? And the reason, of course, is that Chevron has been forum shopping ever since it knew it was going to get a negative verdict against it in Ecuador. That's why the RICO case is here. That's why it's in The Hague. What they want to do is find as many forum as they can to listen to the case without considering the evidence presented by the actual people harmed in the Amazon. That's what they've done in those 2 cases. In Canada, however, where the Ecuadorians are pursuing enforcement of their verdict, presuming a trial there, Chevron will have to defend itself based on the evidence of what happened in Ecuador. And that's a completely different ball of wax because there's absolutely nowhere for them to hide. Whenever the evidence is actually considered, Chevron loses, and it will lose in Canada as well.
Paul Pazzi-Mignot, thank you so much for joining us, and please keep us abreast of what else is unfolding there.
Thank you.
And thank you for joining us on The Real News Network.
Good from the ground. left precious little for me. You remember the flood and the fall. We remember the light on the hill. There should be enough for us all. But the dollar is driving us still. The river runs red, black rain falls, dust in my head. The river runs red, black rain falls, in my bleeding land. So we came and conquered and found riches of commons and kings, who strangled and wrestled the ground, but they never put back anything. Now I'm trapped like a dog in a cage, wherever the truth is pursued. Must be the curse of the age. What's taken is never renewed. The river runs red, black rain falls, dust in my hand. The river runs red, black rain falls.
Listening to Back in the USSR here on 93.3 FM CFRU. And of course, that was Midnight Oil with The River Runs Red. And certainly The River Runs Red or Black or what have you in Ecuador, where of course you've seen we know there's overwhelming evidence that, yeah, Chevron basically destroyed much of the environment there, the environment that people live in, the environment that indigenous people live in Ecuador. They are responsible for that. And that, of course, is why they've been taken to task and, you know, why it is that they're using all these kind of stalling tactics and dirty tricks and all kinds of stuff to get away from taking responsibility for the terrible things that they have done. Like, to the people and the land. Because ultimately, those two things are interconnected. The people and the land are interconnected. You destroy the environment, basically you destroy the people. You know, you abuse the environment, you abuse the people. That's certainly what Chevron has been doing in Ecuador, and they have to be taken to task for that. Now, I suppose I should talk a little bit about my experiences, more specifically about my experiences on this trip I took to Washington. It was the first time I'd been to the the States at all since I was a kid, and the first time I've ever been, certainly ever been to Washington, D.C., like ever. So it was very, very new experience for me. I went as part of a group, like I mentioned before, a group, the Human Rights Solidarity Committee, you know, anti-Chevron, Human Rights Solidarity Committee, of mostly of people from the Latin American community in Toronto. And I almost can't describe the community feel that was on this bus. Even the majority of people on this bus were Spanish speakers, and like, you know, they, the majority of the language being spoken on the bus certainly was in Spanish. But just the community that existed there, you know, these people were all compañeros. We were all in this shared struggle against this common enemy. You know, and we know who the enemy is. You know, we know the enemy is Chevron, and beyond that, it is the American empire that is the enemy. You know, that empire which has done the most horrific things imaginable to the people of Latin America over the last 200 years. You know, they understand that. You know, and they know what they're up against. I mean, even going up to the border, crossing the border was a very revealing thing for me. Because me, as somebody who is white, somebody of European descent, I really don't have to worry too much when it comes to border crossings. You know, that's a privilege that I have. You know, I go across the border. Basically, the worst thing I experienced going across the border was, okay, you know, the customs official gets a little surly with me and more or less, you know, he asks, like, if I'm traveling alone. You know, and of course, you know, I'm traveling with a group. I have no idea what the hell he's talking about. You know, it's very clear I'm traveling with a group. What the hell is he doing asking if I'm traveling alone? Now, I found out, of course, a few, you know, about a minute later or so, like, the guy's actually, what he's asking is, okay, am I traveling with alone or with my family? And obviously, I'm traveling alone in that sense. But, you know, he gets a little hostile with me about that and the fact that I'm kind of slow to answer and all that kind of stuff. But, you know, as soon as it's established that, you know, I'm not traveling with my family, he just basically lets me go. You know, there's no further discussion. Meanwhile, some of the other people who were not, you know, who clearly had darker skin, you know, who could not pass as a white person, they got very different treatment from what I got. And, you know, going in the United States, this is no surprise. They, some of them had to give their fingerprints. Some of them were held up for upwards of half an hour at the border before they were finally let go. I mean, it could have been a lot worse. It totally could have been a lot worse. But that happened, and didn't happen to anybody who was European looking. Now, of course, what does that say? Well, we all know what that says, that we're living in a settler colonial situation here. You know, where certain people are definitely privileged over others. You know, and these people, you know, this is the kind of stuff that they have to deal with on an everyday basis whenever they're dealing with officialdom. So that was very revealing, you know. And of course, but like I said before, the everybody was there for each other. The community on this bus was intense. And just as well, because we had a 14-hour bus ride just about, just to get to Washington, D.C. It was an incredibly long time. And, you know, we got an opportunity really to get to know one another. Like a lot of kids, like, I mean, I went with some people who I knew from the Young Communist League. But the majority of people on that bus I did not know. Never worked with them before. Even though some of them were pretty major community organizers in Toronto. And the GTA. But I didn't know who they were. But, you know, I'm in there. Like, they're treating me like I'm a member of the community. They know me. They want me to be there. There's that camaraderie there. I'm accepted. And just, you know, you really got that kind of sense. Of, you know, we're in this together. You know, come thick or thin to the bitter end. You know, we are in this together. And it was just as well because when we were in Washington, we also had to face up to some, certainly some issues. You know, I talked about the demonstration that which we held in Robert Murrah Park, people from all over the United States. I mean, there were, you know, like I said, there was a bus coming down from Toronto. There was a bus coming down from Six Nations down by Brampton. There were buses coming to Washington for this protest from all over the states, like from New York, Tallahassee, Miami. One came from Minnesota, one came from Chicago. I think some people flew in from LA. It was a really an amazing coming together of people. you know, from diverse backgrounds. Most of them were coming from a Latin American sort of background, but like other people came obviously from indigenous communities in Canada who were coming. And there was a really great diversity of people who came together as a community to fight against Chevron and really just take a stand against really imperialism in general and to fight for self-determination of peoples, not just in Ecuador, but in other parts of the world too, like throughout the world. This really was had a broader significance beyond just struggle against Chevron, because we know, all of us activists know, how the issues are connected. We know how the issues are connected. So when we take a stand against Chevron, we know we're also taking a stand against American imperialism, American abuse of Latin America in general, and the exploitation of corporations of Latin American peoples in general. And beyond that, just of peoples around the world. We're taking a stand also against settler colonialism. You know, whether that's in North or South America. And the abuse that's been perpetrated against indigenous people around the world. You know, we're taking a stand on all these things. You know, and we all understood that. That was clearly understood. Nobody was understanding this in narrow terms. I mean, we were standing there outside the World Bank and the IMF. These institutions that have perpetrated colossal misery on peoples around the world. You know, and we understand that. And we understand what we're up against. You know, after the demonstration, we marched down to the White House. You know, we raised the Mohawk and Ecuadorian flags outside the White House in defiance of the empire and what it's done. You know, effectively, we're in Washington, D.C. This is the belly of the beast. This is like the capital of, basically the capital of global imperialism, really. Capital of the American Empire. This is like the ground zero. And you could see that everywhere. I mean, like, you know, just whether it was the snipers on the roof of the White House, the private security standing outside the World Bank and the IMF, all the people in suits who are going around, you know, to these different places who you can tell have a lot of power to affect other people's lives and livelihoods. You know, obviously the White House itself, you know, where, of course, like, you know, probably the most powerful person on the planet lives and resides, you know, who's perpetrated all kinds of abuses against people in Libya, in Syria, in Yemen, all these other places, you know, Pakistan, Afghanistan, Iraq, you know, blown people away with drone strikes, you name it. You know, there's an emperor living in the White House, you know, and this is what the empire does to people around the world. And of course, we kind of got hit in the face with this when we tried to go to a event being put on, a speaking event being put on by the Ecuadorian ambassador at the Center for International Trade, the Ronald Reagan Center for International Trade. You know, how's that for a title? Just off the, this is kind of in between the White House and the Capitol building in downtown Washington, D.C. When we, you know, we were marching quite defiantly through downtown Washington, D.C., our group, including the people from Six Nations, and they had their banners, they had their headdresses on, they had, like, you know, they were being very open. They were openly displaying who they were. And needless to say, this, I could tell, freaked certain people out in the capital city of the American Empire. You know, this stood out very big time, and it wasn't very long before the Department of Homeland Security decided to show its face, and it showed its face in a pretty big way. At first, only one vehicle showed up, and then about seven showed up, you know. And all these agents, you know, like, jump out and stuff like that and, like, try to block our way, you know, as we're going into this building. And they basically forced us to go through a checkpoint, you know, all our stuff getting scanned. You know, this was directed in particular against the indigenous people because they were forced to take off their headdresses. They couldn't bring in their flags or banners or any of that stuff. And they were the ones who got the harshest treatment, definitely out of everyone. Some of them were turned back because, you know, they had their headgear on. That was seen as, I don't know what they saw that as a security risk. I don't know what it was. They gave some sort of bullshit reason. And, they were turned back, you know, and, you know, these people who are the indigenous people of this land got turned back from entering this building. Like, how's that for, like, messed up? you know, by these officials, by these like Department of Homeland Security people. Some of them were persistent and managed to get in eventually. But like that kind of treatment that they kind of received, I mean, that, you know, like how imperialist can you get, really? And, you know, you see that. That was just blatant. Like, it hits you square in the jaw when you see things like that. But, you know, we were not moved. We were not intimidated by that. We continued. We went into the building. We had this reception. We had this event, the speaking event, where Rigoberta Menchú, who won the Nobel Peace Prize in 1992 for her work as a indigenous rights champion in South America, she got up and spoke. The Ecuadorian ambassador spoke. Several other people spoke. People from Six Nations spoke. Some of the elders from Six Nations spoke. And that was a very moving moment for me. I mean, a lot of the people speaking in Spanish, I couldn't really understand what they were saying, except for a few words here and there. And not the translation wasn't very good. But when the people from Six Nations got up there and they expressed solidarity with the indigenous people of Latin America and in solidarity with people around the world fighting against colonialism and imperialism, and how they talked about how there was a great awakening that's emerging now, that's coming about now, where people, you know, the Incan prophecies, as they said, are coming true. The people of the land of the Condor, South America, and the people of the Eagle, you know, the indigenous peoples of North America are coming together. They are rising together. They're walking hand in hand. You know, and this was the message. I mean, at first this elder delivered his message in his own language, you know, the Iroquois language. But, and when another person from Six Nations was asked to translate for him, you know, he basically couldn't do it. Like, he just teared up. Like, it was just so powerful. He couldn't give the translation. Eventually, the elder himself had to give the translation in English about what he himself had said. And yeah, it was very, very moving. Very powerful, very internationalist message. It was couched in very spiritual terms, but a very internationalist message of international solidarity in the face of imperialism, capitalism, all these things that are destroying the world. You know, and these people, they understand what's up. They understand that they have to come together, that we have to understand, they understand that, you know, we're in this together. There has to be solidarity across borders. We have to defy those borders. We have to really come together. We have to, like, really make things happen. We have to stand. We have to resist. And we have to awaken to the reality of what's going on around us and understand that what we have to do is come together. We have to resist. We have to stand together. We have to fight. And that was really what kind of, I can't do justice to what he said. Like, there's no way. You know, there's absolutely no way. And afterwards, he and Rigoberta Menchú embraced, symbolizing, and lit a flame together, a candle, symbolizing the spirit, the defiant spirit of the indigenous people of North and South America, and how they're coming together now, and they're fighting back, they're resisting, and they refuse to die, they refuse to back down, they refuse to be intimidated. You know, they're resisting colonization now, even now, and redoubling their efforts. So that was very meaningful for me. I mean, this was a life-changing experience for me. I mean, no question about it. Like, just to be there in the capitalist city of the American empire, and yet to see that defiance from people who have been victimized by that empire, and see them take a stand and not be moved, not be intimidated, even when the forces of the state come out and try to repress them and subject them to all these indignities and all this sort of stuff, which they went through. And some of them went through, like, at the border as well, even coming into the United States to begin with. So it shows, like, the undying nature of the human spirit and the spirit that refuses to be repressed. I really don't know what else I can say. But human dignity was displayed there by these people. And I was proud to stand with them. Now please stay tuned to Back in the USSR.
Yeah, I'm well. return of a buffalo, and for a better day to come.
You can kill my body, you can damn my soul, I'm not believing in your God and some world down below. You don't stand a chance against my prayers. You don't stand a chance against my love. Your logical stance, your logical stance. We shall live again. We shall live again. My sister above, but she has red paint. She died of wounded knee. Like a Latter-day Saint. You got the big drum in the distance, the blackbirds in the sky. That's a sign that you hear when the buffalo cry. But you don't stand a chance against my prayers. You don't stand a chance against my love. Your logical stance, your logical stance. We shall live again. We shall live again. Crazy Horse was a mystic. He knew the secret of the trance. And Sitting Bull, the great apostle of the ghost dance. Come on, the ranch. Come on, Shoshone. Come on, Cheyenne.
Hi, I'm James Gordon, and you are fortunate enough to be listening to CFRU 93.3 FM in Guelph.
Hi, my name is Peter, and I volunteer at CFRU because it's a space that really encourages creativity and expressing yourself.
My name is Stacy. I love discovering music that sounds good to me. All kinds of music.
I love the people, I love the atmosphere, and everyone loves radio, and you can tell.
If you love radio and would like to get involved, volunteer at CFRU. No previous experience is required, and we provide all the training. Check out our website at cfru.ca or call Christopher at 519-824-4120. extension 58341, or email volunteer@cfru.ca.
Volunteering at CFRU breeds minds, breeds culture. So come on down.
Pour les francophones et francophiles de la région, CFRU diffuse l'Éclipse, l'émission musicale française à tous les vendredis de 9h à 10h le matin. Si vous faites partie d'une groupe ou une organisation francophone locale qui veut se faire distinguer ou bien vous voulez contribuer à notre programme, s'il vous plaît, me contactez, Sandra Doucette, par courriel francophone@cfru.ca. Soyez à l'écoute tous les vendredis de 9h à 10h pour les annonces, les événements d'actualité et bien sûr la bonne musique française.
May 9th marks the 2015 Women's Dance Retreat, an annual fundraiser hosted by the Flying Dance Festival in Guelph. On this day, women get to hang out and have fun with their girlfriends, mums, daughters, and sisters while taking part in dance workshops in a comfortable and welcoming environment. Styles include Zumba, belly dancing, flamenco, burlesque, and more. The event will take place at Hope House at 75 Norfolk Street, Guelph, with doors opening at 9 a.m. The cost for the retreat varies. A full day pass is $90, a half day pass $50, and individual workshops cost $20. To register, check out their website at www.fdfest.com. You can also email them at flyingdancefestival@gmail.com or call 1-519-265-5508. Hope House is a physically accessible space.
All right, you're listening to Back in the USSR here on 93.3 FM CFRU. Just before the break, I was talking about my experience in Washington, D.C. Just this past week in solidarity with the people who were going down to, oppose what Chevron has done to Ecuador. And, and the Amazon in general. And really to make a stand, against imperialism, against colonialism, with the indigenous people of Ecuador, of North America, of South America. And just, all these issues are connected. Everything is connected. And really we have to understand that if we really want to fight back effectively against the injustice that we see in the world. And certainly that's something I've come to understand during my time, as an activist, as somebody who's really done this for a long time. And, I don't just talk about this stuff. I mean, obviously I have this radio show and everything, but I don't just talk about this stuff. I actually do things. I go to Washington, D.C. and, ride 14 hours and go and do this sort of thing with these people. And obviously I was at the Board of Governors meeting when the students shut it down. Last week here at the University of Guelph, I was part of the students who came in and shut it down. I was proud to do that, to take that kind of stand against rising tuition fees, against program cuts and all that sort of stuff. I do these things. Earlier tonight, I kind of had to cut it short because I had to come and do the show, but I was at the May Day dinner that was being put on by Forza Perorza at Sheldale Community Center here in Guelph. That was happening tonight, and I was there and I was listening to a speech that was given by a fellow student of the 43 students who disappeared last year in Mexico. Some of them who have just disappeared, we don't know what happened to them. Others have been found dead, shot by the police, and just the terror. That people are experiencing now in Mexico at the hands of the government, in conjunction with basically drug cartels who largely work hand in glove with the capitalist state in Mexico, but also to hear about the resistance that's going on down there, the people who refuse to be intimidated, the people who are standing up, people who are fighting back, mobilizing, marching in the streets, putting on discussions like this, going to other countries, letting people know what's really going on in this country that a lot of people only know as, a holiday destination. People go to resorts and stuff from places, people from Canada go down there and go to resorts. They have no idea about what the real Mexico and what's really going on there. And it has to be brought home to people. People have to This has to be made known. By any means necessary. You know, we have to get people out of their bubbles, out of their little worlds that they're in, and let them understand the nature of the world and the reality that we're actually living in, and what needs to be done. Because we're going to have to act. We're going to have to take action if we want to live in a better world. This must be understood. This is very important to understand. And, you know, I guess more or less where I can take it from here, I think what I'm going to do is, because, of course, I was in Washington, D.C., and, of course, outside the White House, and I think this would be an appropriate time in the show for me to play Michael Parenti's talk. This is about 10 minutes, where he actually talks about what the American presidency is, who the president is, and what their function within the capitalist system and within global imperialism is. Just there's no illusion in anybody's mind what really goes on in the American capital and the destruction that the decisions that are made in that city wreck upon the lives of people around the world. And in the United States as well. So I want to play that for you right now. This is Michael Parenti talking about the American presidency. So please stay tuned to Back in the USSR.
The authors of American government textbooks like to point out that the president plays many roles. He has many roles. He's not only chief executive, we hear, but he's also the leader of his party. He's a chief legislator in the sense that he proposes a legislative program. He's in the policy process. And he's also commander-in-chief. And he's also the head of state, the way sort of the Queen of England is, you see. He's an embodiment. When I wrote my American government textbook, Democracy for the Few, with a sort of anti-textbook, actually, I said, there's another role that he has, which none of these other books have mentioned. He's the guardian and representative of capitalism. He's the embodiment of the executive-centered state system that defends American corporate interests at home and abroad. I'm quoting from one of my favorite authors right now, as a matter of fact. Every modern president has had occasion to praise the free enterprise system and denounce collectivist alternatives. William Shannon's description of President Ford, back when William Shannon used to criticize conservatism. President Ford, it could easily apply to any number of other presidents. Quote, he follows the judgment of the major international oil companies on oil problems in the same way that he amiably heeds the advice of other big businesses on the problems that interest them. He is a solid believer in the business ideology of rugged individualism, free markets, and price competition, virtues that exist more clearly in his mind than they do in the practices of the international oil industry. Unquote. The president is, I maintain, the top salesman of the system. He conjures up reassuring images about the State of the Union. Nixon, America is number one. Reagan, America is standing tall. America is the greatest. This is what Ronald Reagan was saying to a nation with 35 million citizens living below the poverty level, millions unemployed, hundreds of thousands homeless, a record trade deficit, and a runaway national debt. Whether Democratic or Republican, liberal or conservative, the president tends to treat capitalist interests as synonymous with the nation's well-being. Presidents greet the accumulation of wealth as a manifestation of a healthy national economy. Regardless of how that wealth is applied or distributed or what's it being used for. I mean, what's this wealth being used for? Is it being used to make more yachts? Or is it being used for housing for working people? Ronald Reagan, quote, America will achieve new heights spurred on by freedom and the profit motive. Ronald Reagan, I want America always to be a country where someone can become a millionaire. Ronald Clinton. Ronald Clinton on the McNeil Lair. Quote, this is a free enterprise country, said President Clinton. I want to create more millionaires in my presidency than Bush and Quayle did. What an ambition. What a goal. He didn't say that. He didn't say that during the campaign. During the campaign, he was Jesse Jackson.